First of all, I'm going to talk a little bit about Android itself and to kind of give you an idea of how everything fits together to kind of make everything a little bit more... Okay, I'm nervous. Then I'm going to talk about all these various different ways of approaching Android without Java. I've put together a demo that I've implemented using some of these techniques, and the code is available on GitHub, so you can check it out and kind of do some comparisons of what it looks like using different languages. So let's start with Android itself. Why choose Android? There's a lot of smartphone operating systems out there. Some of them are arguably more free, like Myomo, Migo. I personally use a Myomo phone. Others are not so free. Like, for example, the Apple App Store is not compatible with the GPL. Android has an ecosystem that is friendly to open source products and is an open source product itself. So my conclusion is that it's the pragmatic choice for open source mobile development, which is a booming industry these days. So to understand how everything puts together, at the very basic level, you have the Linux kernel that we all know and love. On top of that, we have a number of libraries. Many of these you're probably familiar with that kind of give you all the functionality on your device. The first kind of Android unique aspect to this architecture is the Android runtime. It's the Dalvik virtual machine, which is a lot like the Java virtual machine, but not quite. So from this point on, core libraries and everything on up is written in Java. We have the primary interface into the platform is through the application framework. So all your applications sit on top of this application framework. They don't have access to, you know, the stuff in green and red directly. It has to go through all the blue. So what does it mean? It means that you're kind of forced to work within the confines of this Java-based environment. But what if you don't want to work with Java? You know, for whatever reason, you don't know the language, not interested in learning. You know, it's way too verbose, so you just plain hate it. Well, you know, this is a good question, and this is what I'm hoping to help answer here today. So there's a lot of different alternatives, and I'll go through them one by one. So the first thing is web applications. I mean, this is fairly straightforward. You know, you can throw something on a website, and people can browse it and use it. It runs on in a browser. What kind of defines the web application is that it runs in a browser environment. And so you use HTML, you know, style sheets, and JavaScript to program. So you can actually run directly any browser, or you can run any browser widget. Pretty much all the different smartphone platforms have a web view or a web UI widget of some sort that allow you to put in your HTML, JavaScript, and all that and run it inside a different application. So if you're going to take this approach, one thing that's really important is to leverage a lot of the features of HTML5. You'll have access, at least on Android, to video geolocation, and you'll want to make use of features such as cache, the offline cache, so that if your user loses their internet connection, your app doesn't completely stop working. So what are the advantages of choosing to do web app as your development? Obviously, it's a common technology. Lots of people know how to do HTML and JavaScript and all this. And you can deploy on your server using whatever technology that you're comfortable with, whether it be Ruby, Django, Java EE, if you're so inclined. And this really kind of gives you what is close as possible today, I think, to a true cross-platform experience. I mean, granted, every browser has its little quirks that you have to work around with, and one kind of another advantage is that when you update your web server, everyone gets your updates. If you go through some other mechanism, it can take a lot of time before everyone gets your latest changes. So some of the disadvantages are, naturally, it's a performance. You're not running a native application. It has to, your JavaScript has to go through an interpreter. Your widgets are all, you know, HTML and CSS, so they don't correspond to what's going on in the platform itself. Also, because you're running in the browser, you don't get access to a lot of the things that are on a person's smartphone, like their contact database or sensors or anything else like that. When you deploy through a web server, you can't put something in a market, the Android market or the App Store, that can hurt the chances of your application being found. And although I suppose it's more important for the iOS ecosystem, when you do a web app, it's a web app. You don't get the native experience. Here's a couple of resources. The slides will be available online from Linux Fest website and from my blog. But these are a couple of resources. The first one is just Android's documentation on how to do a web app and their best, you know, practices and pointers. And the mobile boilerplate project is actually something that just came out this past week that gives you a set of templates that help you develop a web app that should perform well in all mobile browsers. So let's talk about some cross-platform tools. The first one of these is PhoneGap, which essentially allows you to package a web app into a package for a particular smartphone operating system. So you program this in large part as if you're programming a web app. You use a JavaScript, HTML, style sheets, and what it provides that's somewhat unique is that it gives you JavaScript libraries that give you access to some of the things in the platform that you don't have access in a plain old web app. And using this approach allows PhoneGap to allow you to package your web app for all the major smartphone operating systems. AppSeller Titanium used to do the same sort of approach, but now they're a little bit different. What they do is you program your app in JavaScript, including setting up the user interface and all that. And what it does is it compiles parts of it to actual native code for either Android or the iOS. But a lot of the actual kind of logic that drives your application is still interpreted at runtime. So it gives you much better performance. I mean, not exactly the performance that you'd get from a native app, but it's a lot better. A completely different approach is RoMobile Roads, which tries to give you essentially Rails for mobile. You develop in Ruby, and it provides you with an MVC-style framework from which you build your application. And it will provide native packages for all the major smartphone operating systems. And they, from my impression, is that they seem to be very kind of enterprise-oriented companies, so you can integrate with a lot of their features, which are commercial. So there's a lot of questions that you ought to consider when you want to go the cross-platform tool route. There's a lot of compromises that you need to make. You know, to get the ultimate in cross-platform, you have to give up a little bit in terms of performance sometimes. Of course, there's issues such as licensing and being dependent on the tool and whatnot. So another approach is to use alternative JVM languages. One of the great things about Java as a whole is the JVM. Java, the language, you may not like, but the JVM is really, I think, the technology that has made Java as dominant as it is today. The not-so-good news is that the virtual machine on Android is not exactly the JVM. It's optimized for the embedded context in which it runs and uses different bytecodes. So as a result, any language that is dependent upon dynamic compilation at runtime isn't going to work, at least not without, you know, hacking the source around to get it to work. On the other hand, any language that's statically compiled or entirely interpreted should still work. But you ought to be aware of the resource limits. When you're working on an Android platform, you have a very small heap that you're allowed to work with. Sometimes I think as small as like 12 or 16 megabytes. And so if your language uses too much of that, that means there's not as much left for your particular application. So the first of these is Rubato, which is built off of JRuby. There's actually two components to this. There's an app that you can get from the Android market that actually provides with you an interactive Ruby shell that you can run and just kind of mess around and see what you can do. The other aspect to it is the Rubato Core. It is a development framework that tries to make it easy for Ruby developers to develop applications completely in Ruby. So it comes with tools, for example, to create your project. It creates your rake file. And here's an example of Hello World. It's pretty simple overall. This is an example of using their domain-specific language for UI setup. Whether or not you want to use a domain-specific language is up to you. I mean, on the one hand, if you use it, you don't have to define your layout in XML. On the other hand, when you define your layout in XML, it's easier to handle portrait mode versus landscape mode versus a small screen versus a large screen. So my impressions. Unfortunately, JRuby introduces a lot of overhead. And unfortunately, at this point, I don't think it's a really, really good choice for doing applications that users will be happy with. You have to be careful about what you code because some of the JRuby features that depend on dynamic compilation won't work. And there's this weird redeploy cycle. Part of the idea is that you can update your app by just copying over scripts to the device without having to repackage it, which can be somewhat time-consuming. But unfortunately, I have found that in order to use this feature, you either have to do it on the emulator or on a rooted phone. And when you want to just reinstall the package anyway, sometimes the old scripts don't get replaced. So what if you're a Ruby programmer and, JRuby's just not going to cut it? Well, there's an alternative. It's called Mira. It's the name comes from the word for Ruby in Javanese. The thing about Mira is that it's Ruby-like. Syntax is inspired by Ruby, but it's still a statically typed language, and it compiles. The nice thing about it is that when you write in Mira, you get essentially the same class file that you would get if you're writing in Java. So here's Hello World. If you're a Ruby programmer, it should look, familiar. There's not too much going on there. It's a little bit more verbose because you don't have this than Rubato because you don't have the domain-specific language that Rubato provides. So the impressions are that it's excellent performance. Essentially, you get the same performance than if you're writing Java. There is a tool called Pinda that helps you set up your project and provides you with a rake file so that you can use all the tools that you're familiar with in Ruby development. One disadvantage is that it's still a very young language and not very well documented. So if you run into problems, there's an IRC channel, there's a mailing list, but that's just one of the trade-offs that you have to make with Mira. Scala is more of an academic language that combines the kind of functional and object-oriented paradigms. And actually, it's a very powerful language. In many ways, it's a much better Java. It has a very good type inference. You don't have to be naming your types all over the place, but it's still statically typed. And it's very concise, and it makes it really easy to reuse code. So the Hello World, if you look at the syntax, it looks somewhat like kind of a merger of Ruby and Java. You have some curly braces, and you have some defs in there. It's hard to really see the power you get from just such a simple Hello World, but that's how you do it. So there is a popular build tool in the Scala, community called Simple Build Tool that has an Android plugin that really makes it really easy to develop in Scala for Android. And ultimately, you get very good performance. My experience has been is that it uses a bit more memory than, say, Java or Mira, but the performance otherwise is just as good. And so it's a great option if you're, say, a Java programmer who's, you know, tired of all the typing and you want, well, public static void main, you know, and you want something that can, so you can code faster and easier. Clojure, which is a favorite of mine, is a Lisp for the JVM. One of the main selling points for Clojure is that it helps you solve the concurrency problem as part of the language itself. I mean, we're already seeing multi-core phones coming out. It's only a matter of time before we have quad-core, 8-core, 256-core smartphones. So concurrency is something that we're all having to face in programming, and Clojure tries to provide the tools for you to handle it in a reasonable fashion. I have developed a Clojure REPL for the for Android that's available on the Android market, so if you want to download it and play with it, it's available. So here's Hello World in Clojure. Again, it's a little bit more verbose than I'd like, but that's because there's, you know, certain things I need to do to get it to interoperate with the Java platform or the Java APIs. In bigger examples, it tends to be more concise. So unfortunately, one of the problems with Clojure is that its startup and memory is still a little bit slow. It's not as bad as JRuby, but it's not as good as it really needs to be, I think, for prime time. The good news is that the people, the core team behind Clojure recognize this, and they're working on improvements to make a leaner, meaner Clojure runtime. I've also been developing a Neko library. It's just another API that you can use from Clojure to make more idiomatic use within Clojure of the Android APIs. Somewhat as JRuby is to Mira, Clojure is to Kawa, roughly speaking. It's a schema implementation for the JVM, and like Mira, allows you to write in a different language but still essentially have the same Java performance or native Java performance. And it actually includes some Android support built into the language itself. So as you can see, the Hello World for Kawa is actually rather concise. So my overall impressions of Kawa is that it gives you the, you know, the best performance you can get on the machine. Unfortunately, it's a rather obscure language. I mean, how many people heard of Kawa before coming here today? One, which is actually not bad. So there's not a whole lot of tool support. So if you're looking to build in Kawa, I mean, you'll have to kind of hack your build.xml yourself and whatnot. It's not too bad, but that's one of the trade-offs for that. Oops, skipped a bit. So overall, the advantages of using a JVM language are that you have the full access to the native APIs, and you can choose a language that you're comfortable with whose tools you're comfortable with. And some of these languages actually run very well on Android. Unfortunately, others do not. And even on the languages that run really well, you'll sometimes find that there are cases when trying to interface with Java, things don't work out quite as well as you'd hope. So the next option is the scripting layer for Android, which kind of takes a different approach. It aims to bring even non-JVM languages to Android. And so there's an actual app that you can download from their website that gives you the ability to install interpreters, you know, run them in an interactive console, edit files, run scripts, you know, just have fun with it. And there's actually a lot of languages that are supported, and it's relatively easy to add new languages to the infrastructure. So how does this work? At the very basic level, the scripting layer for Android exposes what it calls facades that are essentially APIs that give you access to certain parts of the Android APIs. So when you write your application, you include an interpreter for the language that you're running in, and it uses JSON-RPC calls to go between the language that you're working in and the underlying platform. So there's no, for languages that don't require an additional level of interpretation at runtime, you don't get it. I mean, you do have these JSON-RPC calls, but you don't have to worry about extra layers of interpretation that hurt your performance. Nonetheless, it is designed more for ease of use and not performance. I mean, that JSON-RPC is overhead. And because you're running non-JVM languages and you have to go through the JSON-RPC, you don't have access to the full range of the native Android APIs, unless you're running in a language that can invoke Java directly, like JRuby or Bean Shell or Rhino, which is JavaScript. So writing scripts, there's a bunch of ways that you can do this. Ultimately, the best way to do it is to actually, you can run a server on your phone or on the emulator, and then on your computer, your development machine, you can edit your scripts there and actually send them off to be run on the phone. So it makes you can essentially code very dynamically. Write a few lines, send it off to the interpreter, and just see what happens. You know, did it work? Did it not work? You can also package a script as an app, but it requires a separate interpreter at installation. So the user would download your app, and the first time they'd run it, it says, you know, you have to install Python. And so they have to go through a little process of installing Python. So the advantage is that it's really easy to develop things, and the APIs are really easy to use so that, well, it's easy. I find I'm using easy a lot. It's ideal for scripting a device. That locale that I was mentioned in an earlier slide is an Android application that essentially can do things in certain situations. If you're in a given address or after a given time, and so actually there's a plugin so that can kick off an arbitrary script using the scripting layer for Android. So if you want to automate your phone, this is a great way to do it. So some of the disadvantages is it's not really suited for writing applications for end users. I already mentioned the multi-step installation, but also your UI options are limited to either using HTML in a web view or dialogues. And the performance, as I said, isn't the best. But it's great for hacking on your phone. And, I mean, if your primary audience is other, you know, geeks, then it's pretty good. So the last option I'm going to talk about is the one that comes from Android themselves, the Native Development Kit, which was originally introduced back in, like, Android 1.5 because, frankly, performance wasn't all that great. At that time, Android did not have a just-in-time compiler. They do now. So it's designed to, essentially, you can put your performance-critical code and implement it or have it compile to the machine language of the machine that you're running on. So as a result, it's not a replacement for the standard development kit. And more importantly, you have to realize that you're still running inside of this Dalvik virtual machine. You're not running as a native process on the on your device. But what does allow you to do is actually have direct access to some of these libraries, which are in green. So developing with the NDK is actually not too bad. You download the NDK, and it provides you with pretty much all you need for cross-platform development. You know, the compiler, the entire build chain, you know, the system libraries and headers, debugger. And what it does is that when you compile, you build a shared library, and you use the SDK to bundle your application. So here's an example from Java declaring a native method. If you've used JNI before, this is not new to you. Pretty much you just declare, which with stub methods essentially, what you want to run in C, and you have this system.load library to that actually tells Java to load your shared object or shared library. The C part is just implementing a function. As you can see, it's somewhat clunky, and that's one of the disadvantages to working with JNI. The makefile, on the other hand, is pretty simple. I mean, it's almost, you can copy this and just replace the local module and local source files, and it'll do everything that you need it to do. Now, it is possible as of Gingerbread, I guess, Android 2.3, which was released in December, to make an activity or an app that is 100% C or C++ code. But it's not recommended, but you can do it, and there's a couple of ways to do it. The recommended version is you essentially implement an event loop, and the Java side will just throw events at you, and it's up to you to handle them. One of the disadvantages to this approach is that your user interface is restricted to OpenGL. So this might not be so bad if you're going to do, say, a game that's all OpenGL anyway. But, I mean, if you're doing more of a standard form or something like that, it's probably not the way you want to go. So there's the obvious use case for the NDK, which is performance-critical code. I think a great use case for this is that if you already have a library that you want to reuse, this is a good way to do it. An interesting way to apply that is to actually embed an interpreter. Such a Lua and Gambit scheme have been done before, so it's a bit hackish, but you know, it's a way to do things. So, demo. Some of you may have seen this already. I guess we were testing the sound earlier. So it's a simple guess the number game with a war games twist. The code is available on GitHub. I've implemented it in all these different languages. I'll have to warn you that I'm not necessarily an experienced practitioner in all of these languages, so my implementation may not be the most idiomatic or the best. So let's take a look at this. So we'll run the Scala version. It's a little bit slow on... So let's... Too high. 42? Still too high. Yeah, I guess 23. Too low. Well, I guess I found.
Congratulations, you won.
So you can see an implementation in all those various languages from GitHub. So I kind of give you a chance to see what a slightly non-trivial application looks like. I would have done more, but I only have so much time. So I thought I'd do some statistics or, you know, measure a few things just to see, to compare between the different implementations. Package size is important because this is what your users are going to download. And since, you know, wireless data is very expensive, you want to keep this as small as possible. Installed size is arguably not quite as important, but... I mean, it's still an embedded device, and you don't have that much space for applications on your phone. I think startup time is a very important metric because it's going to be like the first thing that your user is going to see. And if it takes too long to load, they're not going to be happy with your application. Now, You can manage expectations to a certain extent. Some apps you really expect to come up immediately. Others are naturally going to take time to load, such as games. Heap use, as I mentioned, is important because you only have so much of it, and you better make good use of it. Lines of code is always a dubious metric, but I thought I'd include it nonetheless, just for the sake of comparison. This is not a complicated enough application to really see large differences, but you can see that JNI is huge, mostly due to some of the really clunky interface between the C, or trying to do Java from C. And Scala was surprisingly the lowest here, because even though it was a small application, being able to use some of the really neat features in Scala, I was able to do some code reuse in ways that aren't possible in some of the other languages. So is Android without Java possible? I think I've answered here that it's definitely a yes, with some qualifications. Some technologies are really ready for use and are being used. Others, such as Mira and Kawa, I think that you can use production. For right now, the development experience might not be the absolute most optimal, but you can certainly use them. Other technologies aren't quite there yet. Clojure and Rubato, I just think that the overhead right now is just too much for a good user experience. And scripting layer for Android is a really neat project, but I think it's really more of a niche product than something you can really use for mainstream development. I suppose I should mention some non-free alternatives. MonoDroid is a commercial product that you can do if you are like C Sharp. And Adobe Air is, if you like, doing Flash. And that's it, I guess. Any questions? Yes.
Sure. Is there a version of Forth available?
Not that I know of. Yes. It is written in, I believe, mostly just C, C++.
NDK?
No, not the NDK itself. I mean, you can download the source code for it, and I believe most of it's all just in C. Any other questions? Yes?
Okay, well, I'll put it, since you talked about Rubato and Mira, I will put in a plug for Lone Star Ruby conference coming up in August.
Okay, you heard it.
Should be there, and they're very nice people, very easy to talk to.
Lone Star Ruby conference coming in August. No. I guess I was interested in doing Android. I guess in the last year or so, I've been doing a lot of stuff in Clojure, which I really like. And so naturally, coming to Android, I was interested in trying to do Clojure on Android. And I have been working on trying to get Clojure on Android to be a better experience. But I thought it would be a great topic since there's a lot of people who are interested in doing mobile development but aren't interested in doing Java development. So I thought I'd take a look at a lot of the different alternatives. Well, I guess that's it. I'll be around for questions if you have, and thanks for dropping by.